Welcome to everyone. I'm so pleased to see you and to see your faces and that you're able to be here and share this meeting. I would like to call for a motion to receive the minutes. If you've all received them, you've all received the minutes. I know they went down, correct? I'll entertain a motion then to accept the minutes.
So moved. Anyone?
Motion has been made. Could I have a second? Okay. Motion has been made and second that we approve the minutes of the December meeting. And I would like to have another motion, if I could, to approve the agenda, approval of the agenda. You all have the agenda in front of you. Could I have a motion to approve the agenda? Curry has approved the agenda. Could I have a second?
Second.
Okay, then the motion has been made that we accept the presented agenda. And we'll move on now to the next item on the agenda, which is my report. I would like to say that we really and truly appreciate all of the updates and information we've received from Dr. Nader regarding the safety of the campus and the safety of the students and all that have the administration, the staff, people all have been doing to keep things up to date. We really appreciate that. And I'm sure that over the past few weeks and months, we have received information via newsletter, via town halls, and the information has been good that I have received from outside and others that Farmingdale is really up to par and safely moving forward under the pandemic. So with that, we'd like to thank Dr. Nader and everyone on staff for all that they're doing to keep the campus moving forward. The other bit of information I'd like to share is that I will be hosting an executive meeting of the Association of College Council Members and Trustees Friday. And the key of that meeting will be to focus on whether or not to give up the contract that we have for the October annual meeting, or if we are to continue. You know, we gave it up last October and had a virtual conference, which was very, very well received. But now we have to determine whether we will lose our money if we don't by April 1, if we want to reschedule for 22 and have another virtual meeting in October. If any of you would like to give me an opinion to share, I would appreciate it. Kathleen and Curry and Paul, we believe that it would be safe in order to keep our contract in place if we were to move it to October 22, rather than take a chance that we would be able to have a face-to-face in October 21. How do you feel? Anyone could have one or two opinions about that to take back to the meeting as far as my council members? Yes, Kathleen.
Yeah, I would feel comfortable with October. However, there'd have to be something in the contract regarding the fact that the governor may not allow large group settings at that point, and we should be able to get our money back and reschedule for 2022. But I'm optimistic, and so I'm hoping that by October we'll be able to travel and gather again.
Well, we have to determine April 1 if they will give us our money back.
Well, that would have to.
I didn't add that the governor's legal council members and team, they have been negotiating constantly with the venue to make sure that every point, every sentence in that contract is to our benefit. So that's we felt that it was most important for SUNY and And those on the team are in the chancellor's office as well, and the chancellor's in contact with the governor to do what is best for SUNYs. So we want to do whatever is best in terms of receiving our contract in an appropriate way. And that decision will have to be made by April 1. So as you said, Kathleen, it's risky because we have to go with the governor's decision as well. And I'm sure Chancellor Milatus will feel the same way, but we'll be advised in that way. So
then I would defer to legal counsel and Dave Curry.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Thank you. That's what I think would be best also. We will continue. The other point that I am very much in favor of continuing, which we didn't do last year, is scholarships for the students. As you know, we've always provided two scholarships at that conference. This past year, we did not in October when we had the virtual conference. So I'm going to recommend that we have those two scholarships presented regardless of whether it's virtual or not. So that's the opinion. You have any opposition to that in terms of my decision with them? Because we have the money in the ACT contract, in the ACT treasurer's report. The other thing that will be a great decision to be made by the executive board and the treasurer is whether or not to, as you know, last year we deferred the $1,000 dues to each campus. So this will be a question to at the meeting on Friday. How do you feel about that? Should it be deferred for another year to 22, or should we... we only have to do the scholarships, and that's what I'm very much in favor of. If there's enough money there to do the scholarships, let's do that. If we can do that and defer to the campus so that they won't have to pay the $1,000 campus, then I'm in favor of that. How do you feel? Those of you who've been attending, Kathleen, you've been attending at Curry. I don't know if you've been there, Paul. What do you think, Kathleen?
I think the scholarship should be renewed. I think that was something seriously missing at the last meeting. I'd like to see that resumed. I know colleges are going through a difficult budget time. So if we can, allow them to defer another year, I think that's a great advantage. I know Jim's on and Jim has attended. Attended many meetings, so he might have some input as well.
Okay, I didn't see him. Okay, Jim, how do you feel? Are you in favor or against giving the scholarships this year, regardless of whether we go virtual or in face-to-face with the ACT assembly? As you know, we had two scholarship winners over the past 2 years, and that's good. And we want to continue that. A nursing student, and the year before that we had something else, but we do very well, so I don't want to give that up. I don't hear Jim, so I'm going to move to the next point I wanted to give you. The chancellor started making reappointments and appointments. Many of you on the council know that you've been waiting for that to be done over the past many years. Because you stay in place until you receive a reappointment or until, the chancellor makes that, not the chancellor, the governor makes that decision. But there have been 10 new appointments. And I want to let you know that four council members have been appointed to SUNY Polytech, three to Delhi, two to Maritime, and one to Canton. So, if there are more, I'll hear more about that on Friday. So with that, I guess that will end my report, except one announcement. I'm going to be representing Farmingdale State College Council and the ACT tomorrow in the town of Babylon as a keynote speaker for Black History Month. And that is a privilege and a pleasure that I'll have to pop up Farmingdale, as I always do, because they say, if we know Pat, we know Farmingdale. So if you want to, sign in, you can see it. It's going to be live streamed on the Babylon Town YouTube or whatever, Facebook, on the Babylon Town Facebook. So that ends my report, and I'll turn the, yes?
Yeah. Have you been able to attend any of the SUNY board meetings? And can you give a quick update on whether you will get a voting spot on that board?
I have attended one, and we are going to be discussing that again, because with the new chancellor, the former chancellor passed over that information, which will be presented to the board again. However, we should be aware that that resolution, rather that request, would require legislative approval. So that would have to go through that process, and it would not be overnight. So we will address it again at the meeting on Friday and see just exactly what stage that particular letter is right now. So we'll get back to you probably at the next meeting with another update on that.
Time and stuff.
I'm going to. Yep.
It will take time, and we hope that it will move forward. So, are there any other questions related to my responsibilities over the past? I think I've covered most of it, and I would like to turn the agenda over now to Dr. Nader.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Patricia mentioned that she will be presenting tomorrow, Thursday, February 5th. It's on the Town of Babylon Facebook page. It's at 5 p.m. If you're able to tune in at that point, it will be live streamed through their Facebook page, facebook.com/BabylonTown New York. And it's, I think, a very interesting program, and it's to Patricia's great credit that she's been selected as the keynote speaker. So good for you. And
thank you.
But 5 o'clock tomorrow. Much to report, but we have asked Natalie Rogers, who's our SGA president, to join us, and looking for brief presentations on three topics to fill you in. In terms of my personal report, I'm going to try to keep this very abbreviated, and I may reduce all of this to writing soon in more detail to share, and then more conversation at our April meeting. We are one of the two institutions leading the Offshore Wind Training Institute that the governor announced back in July of 2019. This is just beginning to take shape, and there are many, many questions. We have a conference call lined up with the executive chamber and the chancellor's office on Friday to deal more with this. Marja Sipor from the Renewable Energy and Sustainability Center, with some help from Dominic Esposito from the Office of Sponsored Programs, have been working on a couple of programs that we can do. Stony Brook is looking at a graduate program it can do. Dr. Joseph has been in touch with Maritime for longer term things. I've been in touch with the president at the Maritime Academy to see if they can get a summer academy of some sort up and running. It's an ambitious project. It is a yet to be defined project as well. So I will try to put some of this in writing and get it out to you. More good news, and I told Patricia this morning, almost everything we have to touch on, I think, is really good in some way or another. We were informed a couple of weeks ago that the State University Construction Fund is approving a $30 million rehabilitation of Roosevelt Hall. We've had, and I'm going to give facilities credit here, and this dates back to the time when I arrived, we have kept this project in the forefront in case the construction fund found that other campuses were not able to complete or initiate projects. We were notified, I believe, in late January, if I'm not mistaken, that we will be able to go ahead with Roosevelt Hall. This is an overused term, but in that part of campus, especially given what we're hoping to do in Laffan, this could truly be a transformative project for the campus at this point. And I appreciate the construction funds keeping us on their radar for projects. In terms of testing, you may be aware that everyone with a regular on-campus presence is expected to test. This is pooled saliva testing on a weekly basis. We have a very high level of compliance. So since about February 1st, we have performed over 3,000 tests. We have about half a dozen positives from our own testing as a result of that. Health and Wellness and Student Affairs, particularly Frank Rampello, deserve a lot of credit for doing this. In addition, Dental Hygiene and Biology will be providing some evening testing hours as well, and Dr. Joseph has worked with them along those lines. I cannot say enough about the level of compliance. We have a plan to reach out to non-compliant students, but the truth is students have been showing in very large numbers to do the testing. We did testing prior to the beginning of the semester as well. Our commencement committee is recommending that we continue with a commencement in May. Of 2021. Because of the amount of uncertainty out there, they are recommending that that is the best avenue for us at this point, and they're beginning to make appropriate plans to enhance what we did back in May of 20 so that Laura and Kathy Wolverton don't have to run back and forth to vehicles to get student names and others as well. We have tri-chairs now who are working on this, and they're beginning to work on parking spots. And I have asked Dr. Jordan and Student Affairs to begin to reach out to seniors so that we can solicit suggestions on that. Our Middle States reaccreditation self-study is completed. I will ask that it be sent on to everybody today or tomorrow so that they have an electronic version of this. The campus visit will be in April. We have a very, very good team chair, and she was very pleased with earlier drafts of this. Dr. Joseph has some feedback from SUNY expressing their satisfaction with what I think is a well-done self-study that represents us very well. Most of you know that we've been reacting to COVID in many ways since almost a year ago. However, Dr. Joseph has begun plan for fall 21, and I'm going to ask her to take just a couple of minutes to summarize our thinking at this point, and then Dr. Jordan and I can fill in some blanks on the residential side of this. And Laura, maybe you want to talk about summer 21 as well.
Sure. Thank you. So as you know, our current spring semester, we have about 85% of our course sections being taught remotely and about 15 on campus. As we move into the summer term, we're looking to bring more students back to the campus. We'll continue with online courses, our traditional online courses, traditional hybrid classes, but then the majority of remaining sections will be on campus for our students. And then as we transition into the fall, the thinking is that we're going to flip the ratio and have at least 75% of our course sections being taught on campus in the fall. But this does present some difficulties and challenges. Thinking that COVID issues are still being in play, where we have to maintain social distancing, where there will be masking requirements, we need to think about our space on campus and how best to utilize that space. So after discussions with the department chairs and deans and so forth, we've decided to work towards implementing an A-B type weekly schedule where a core section would be divided into two groups. It, you know, it would be the same course, but we would utilize live stream technology to assist us. And students would register for either the A group or the B group and come to campus during that assigned week. So the instructor will be in class every week. The students will be in person in class every other week. And then on the alternate week, they would be viewing the class via live stream and participating remotely. This will give us a good amount of space to utilize. Thinking that we would be using spaces that are unconventional, maybe the ballroom space, maybe some seminar classes will be held in conference rooms. But we're going to do our best to bring back the campus community to the institution and continue with the importance of meeting face-to-face.
Are there any questions, comments on any of the things that we're reporting or that Dr. Joseph is laying out here for fall of 21 that we can address?
Any questions?
I got one question.
Oh, Jim. Yes.
Yeah, sorry about the problem. I had technical problems. I just got a new laptop yesterday and I've downloaded all the new programs. So it's I was on, but the audio wouldn't work. But
understandable.
Hey, learning from the technology from Farmingdale, you always get through. Laura, I was curious, what is the percentage of increase compared to last from this previous fall semester? Are we going a number of how much did that increase compared to last year on the fall semester?
All of
bringing students back on campus.
The fall of 2020. We had, again, about 15% of our classes in person. So we're really going to do like a flip of that. You know, we're looking to put 85% of the students back on campus in the fall of 2021. And we'll continue to offer our traditional distance learning classes and our hybrid classes, but we're really looking to increase the student population back on campus in the fall.
Okay. Will the classes be small?
Yeah, so we're going to need to maintain, you know, the COVID capacity caps for our classes. So that's, you know, the reason for the utilization of an AB week. So if a classroom space only allows 10 students at a time, we can still enroll the class with 20 students, but then only allow half attend every other week in person, where the other group would be engaging through the live stream technology. And thanks to our IT department, you know, for really stepping up and making sure that our rooms have the technology that would be needed to offer this type of course.
Laura, if I might offer some feedback from the chair people, since the meeting that was held a few days ago, there is some pushback. There is some discussion about the fact that the big flaw in this plan is that although we will be teaching on campus continuously, we will be glued to a machine. So we won't be interacting with the students who are coming in person in class the way we usually do. It won't be dynamic. If I might suggest, and you might not like this, but if I might suggest that we invest in some hardware that would follow the instructor around the room so that whiteboards and blackboards could be used as usual and faculty could interact with the students as usual, it would greatly enhance what we would be doing in the fall. It would make it much more honest as an in-person exercise.
You talk about protection equipment for the instructor?
Yes.
Okay.
So thank you, Lloyd, for that feedback. I'll bring it back, you know, to our IT department. I know that they're looking at upgrading what we currently are doing, the cameras and the connections, so that the broadband is good, so that we don't lose, you know, lose connection during a class section. And they're looking closely at as well. It is a stopgap. You know, this is something that we need to put in place for the fall. My hope is that when we look ahead to spring 2021, that we will not need to deal with this challenge. But we pivoted very well from in-person classes to remote learning in the spring of 2020. And then in the fall of 2020, we continued on that trajectory, and we provided the necessary training to deliver quality educational programs to our students. You know, we had to again continue with this into the spring, and now is the time for us to begin that pivot back to campus, what it will look like, how we're going to get through that semester. It might not be perfect, but it will allow us to have at least the connection with our students that we so desperately would like to have.
And Provost Joseph, just to add to that, you know, we are investing in high-def, wide-angle cameras that provide a 12-foot radius so that teachers don't feel tethered to the desk, and that they can move, you know, from side to side and have a great viewing angle. It's not follow them around the classroom, but it will give them the ability to, you know, move around the front of the classroom pretty nicely. We are looking at, you know, other solutions, but those solutions come with a great cost. So we'll be more targeted in those deploys.
I got one question. I'm curious about Dr. Carr. What are they doing in a high school to protect their staff in a classroom? It's something that they're doing in a high school, or they're planning in the future, maybe we could utilize into the higher education system.
The solution that is currently being offered is what we're currently doing. In our elementary as well as secondary schools, we also have teachers who are teaching both in-person students and students who are at home. We're in an A-B rotation, somewhat different. We have students who come in Monday, Tuesday in A group, and students who come in Thursday, Friday in B group, and alternating Wednesdays. Our challenges are somewhat different from the college level in that we have younger students. And so, of course, there's been many concerns by both parents and teachers as it relates to younger students in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade, because they don't have the capacity to self-regulate and self-manage. At the high school level, we also have challenges in that there are students who have tuned out. While they show up, they don't tune in. So having kids at home poses certain challenges for us. But again, I think it has a lot to do with the developmental stage, ages of students. But there are students who are benefiting from the experience, not all students. Our goal right now is the full return of all students to in-person learning. But we have received signals from the Commissioner of Education that it's probable that we will still have to remain somewhat remote next year, or provide that option to parents who choose not to send their kids back to school.
Interesting.
Laura, what sort of messaging is coming down from SUNY? Are they pressing the universities and colleges to go back full time, or are they leaving it up to individual campuses to determine what works best for them?
So if I may, Patricia, that's a great question, Kathleen. We have no additional guidance from the university system this semester as to fall of 2021. The chancellor has indicated that it's his hope to return to much more on-campus presence. He actually announced the plan yesterday for spring athletics to be played in the SUNYAC conference face-to-face for the outdoor spring sports, and has indicated to the presidents he would like more on-campus presence in the fall. But I specifically asked week before last if there's any additional guidance on this, and at this point there is none. And what Dr. Joseph has done with the deans and others is try to develop a plan that will remain compliant with the distancing and other requirements and allow us to have an on-campus presence that we've been lacking for a year now, as of next month. That's a very good question. We're hoping for more. Some of these criteria or requirements may be relaxed if the rates of positives and hospitalizations decline. Interestingly, the Skyline Conference plan for athletics in the spring is virtually identical to the SUNY one, and we play in Skyline. We developed it actually before the SUNY-AC conference did, and we're proceeding with that like this week in terms of outdoor practice, beginning this week. So that's where that stands.
Dr. Knight, I have a question. The instructions that the chancellor would have to follow would come, or would they have to come from the governor?
They would have to come from the state of New York and the Department of Health, whether that's the executive
well, first from the state,
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Dr. Nader? He could continue.
Yeah, just one question on tuition. I know in the beginning there was pressure from the outside public as far as decreasing the tuition for virtual, even though I'm assuming it probably costs a little bit more because of the technological purchases, but there's still pressure to decrease the tuition from the students for going virtual as compared to in-person?
What we've done, Paul, is to hold tuition flat here for the I'll call them COVID semesters. We have, however, dramatically either eliminated or reduced a variety of fees so that the student who attended Farmingdale in 1920 academic year or even the year before may actually be here this academic year, the 2021 year, paying less in total than she or he did previously while we are face-to-face because we worked in academics and in finance to contain, reduce, or eliminate our fees. The tuition remains flat as it stands right now. And we have not received a lot of questioning about that. We've certainly had some, no doubt, but we have not been inundated with calls, requests, inquiries about our tuition and fee structure. And some students actually seem to realize that they're paying somewhat less than they would have roughly a year, year and a half ago.
Okay, thank you.
Since you mentioned that, Paul, we did with our dormitory committee meet at the beginning of the week. Dr. Jordan convened the group. It's our intention going forward to expand our residence hall occupancy in the next academic year. It is our intention not to raise room rates at that time.
If you could continue, Dr. Nader, if there are no other questions to that issue.
I'm going to turn it over to the three presenters whom we put on the approved agenda for today and ask them to be succinct because we do have an executive session and I know Dave indicated he needs to leave. But we've been waiting to hear from Natalie and I thank Natalie Rogers very, very much for joining us. A very active SGA president who has many thoughts about how we can improve the institution and has a great connection with her constituency. And Natalie wanted to talk briefly about some of the things that are going on at SGA.
Very good. Natalie?
Thank you for the introduction. Let me just share this quickly. Just to reopen this. Okay, I'll try and keep it fairly brief. Let me just share my screen. All right. So, hello everyone. I know my name is Natalie Rogers. I'm the SGA president. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I know we've had a general introduction, but some background about me. I've been a part of SGA since 2017. Last year I was the vice president. I graduated from Farmingdale last spring with a bachelor's in visual communications, and I'm currently pursuing a certificate in computer systems technology to focus on web development. So beyond focusing on advocacy in SGA, my background career-wise is more on user experience and creative problem solving. So the big question for the year is, how do we rebuild our community remotely? Last spring and fall, the focus was on getting students familiar with distance learning, but how do we increase student engagement and where do we go to from here? So one of the biggest factors that affects student engagement and involvement is the overall student experience. Issues that may affect one student's experience are the sense of community, whether or not they feel comfortable communicating with peers, how they're doing overall academically. At the end of the day, what students are going to want to take time out of their week to take to attend an event or a club if they feel overwhelmed by coursework, and how likely are they to be actively engaged in class if they feel lost or alone or isolated. And while this may seem simple, this is very complicated because without a strong student experience, they're less likely to be engaged. But if they're less likely to be engaged and involved on campus, their student experience is much weaker. So how do we navigate this balance and how do we strengthen it? Being that majority of students are learning remotely, if we want to foster a community, we have to focus on humanizing our digital space. The basic framework for the courses may not be enough to help students thrive in how they learn, communicate, and connect with others. So starting with the learning experience, throughout the fall semester, SGA was heavily advocating for certain features to be mandatory for professors to utilize on Blackboard. While we were notified that professors were originally only required to post their rubrics amongst mandatory materials, this excluded grades and assignment deadlines. And being that rubrics are mostly utilized to outline how each section of their coursework is weighted, how is that information relevant if students don't have access to their grades to begin with? And more importantly, how are students able to get help if they don't even know they need it? Especially with the tutoring center and attending office hours. And we had a long conversation with Dr. Nader, Dr. Jordan, Dr. Joseph about this topic, which aided a letter sent out to faculty advocating for this point. But if students are paying for a course, they should have the right to know their grades and have the right to get the help if they need it. Student involvement is, you know, it's not a new topic of conversation, but being that we're restricted to this virtual space, it really changes our approach to how we're communicating with the student body. You know, over the years, we've had a lot of conversations about how powerful the student voice is and how we can get other students involved in their community. For students to be as involved as possible in terms of advocacy, committees on campus need to be publicized. Many of them not only affect student life, but require student representation as well. And while this is the case, the committees aren't publicized on the school website, and they're hard. Some of them are, but they're very hard to find. And while these meetings have agendas and minutes, they aren't available to the student body. And since many of these decisions are being made that affect student life on their behalf, and many students are looking to get involved and student reps are needed, this information should be easily accessible to them. In terms of services, we have to keep in mind what messages are being sent out to the student body. I think our institution has been doing a great job advocating for students to utilize services like mental health services. One social media initiative that SGA will be doing throughout the semester on our side of social media is that we'll be having an SGA rep do an Instagram takeover to advocate for certain services on campus, especially for mental health, something that's more stigmatized. Giving them a perspective that they can relate from will make them more likely to get the help that they need. You know, they'll relate better this way as opposed to, you know, maybe like a scripted video, something along those lines. And for many student services, they've yet to really have a casual conversation. Students have really yet to have a casual conversation with students themselves advocating for them. And while FSC takes pride in being a diverse campus, how are we being perceived? All right. Our only communication with the student body is digitally, and as social media is the face of the organization, any brand. On FSC's social media part, the first mention of Black History Month was on February 10th, which is almost halfway through the month, and it was just a black square that said Black History Month written in white letters. You know, one thing that it's kind of been a tradition for SGA is to highlight influential leaders. We used to do it in person with posters around campus, but we've tried moving that more frequently on our digital space. one of my favorite quotes is from Ava DuVernay. She's an influential Black filmmaker. And it's, when we're talking about diversity, it's not a box to check. It's a reality that should be deeply felt and held and valued by all of us. You know, when the reality is that our BIPOC students, faculty, and staff, our students are going to classrooms where people don't look like them. And odds are they're going to a workforce that's the same way. We should give them people to inspire them, guide them to start their own legacy. And this goes beyond Black History Month as well. Overall, we have to ensure that our BIPOC students, faculty, and staff are being celebrated and supported. And we can do better. If our campus is one of the most diverse campuses in the SUNY system, our faculty and staff has to be equipped with implicit bias training to support them. While this training is optional, when you look up anything along the lines of implicit bias training on the MyFSC homepage, it's really difficult to find information about the trainings. SUNY put out a letter advocating for the importance of diversity training, which was signed by 1,300 college presidents, faculty, and staff, many of which are heavily involved in this institution. And at the end of the day, if we take pride in diversity, we have to value and support it as well. And if we can acknowledge the importance of diversity training, not only campus-wide, but SUNY-wide as well, it should be required. And we have to do our part in supporting our BIPOC community. Especially since a majority of students are online, we need an ombudsman's office to help navigate issues and to serve as an unbiased, independent, and safe space for students, faculty, and staff to resolve conflict. Ombuds are able to resolve conflict not only in office, but they also serve as a center for information to refer students to other resources if need be. Amongst resolving issues, one interesting thing that other SUNY schools right now, their ombudsman's office are doing is that they're offering online workshops that not only inform students on what their office does, but workshops on how they can work better as a team, better their communication skills, and overall provide students with skills that are better that will better their navigation through their life beyond their academic careers. Ombuds are also able to report feedback to administration about trends to help create positive change on campus. And if we're looking to make our campus more engaged, more empowered, an ombudsman's office will help foster that. Thank you for your time and this opportunity, and we're looking forward to working with you, and together we can help rebuild our community. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question for you. You mentioned a lot of things that were related to training or presentations during various special months. Do you have a lot of webinars just for the students through the student government?
Or
do you have any?
Yeah, so I know the Office of Student Activities has frequent programming, and I know on the MyFSC homepage it is advertised throughout February on what services are being provided. Like many of our clubs on campus, like NAACP and OSA as well, are having various events to help celebrate Black History Month. Ourselves, we've been advertising like those clubs and some services on campus. Like they have, like I know the campus mental health services is having a support group, like an empowerment support group right now that we've been advertising. As long as our programming. Daily, we've been posting about influential leaders during Black History Month just to like inspire students. Mm-hmm. We've been highlighting some, like generally we've been highlighting it. We were like showing, Black students who have small businesses as well, just little things here and there that we can do on social media to like celebrate our communities.
Well, that's very good. I'm glad to hear that because I was just going to say that there are a lot of, I would say, representatives that you could use readily now because everything is virtual. You can get top presenters at, drop of a hat sometimes, but you're doing a great job, it seems, with it already. And I also want to let you know that this weekend I will be attending a workshop. It will be virtual, of course, sponsored by our state legislators. If you are familiar with the Black Caucus Weekend, Black, Hispanic, and Latino, Asian Caucus. And I will be attending a workshop that's being presented by a former SGA president who is now one of our leading assemblymen, and that's Clyde Vanell. He's really great. So aspiration everywhere. Opportunity shine. Thank you very much, Natalie. I'll turn it back to Dr. Nader. And to you if you have questions, anybody.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Natalie, very much. And we'll continue to convene with Dr. Jordan and you and follow through on some of these things. We've had many things happen at the foundation and through the Alumni Association recently. And that's thanks to some of you who are participating in today's conversation. I'm going to ask our newest Vice President, Matt Coulson, to just touch on some of the things that are going on there, much of which are really good, including a very large gift that we've recently received. So go ahead, Matt.
Great. Thank you. And good morning. It's great to see you all again. I drafted some bullet points, so I will be short and concise. First is, as we spoke last, the office had a little bit of an identity crisis and confusion around campus and who are we? Are we the foundation office? Are we the alumni office? And then there's this spirit of development and alumni engagement. And so we've worked hard, and I think we accomplished it early on to make it clear to everyone that we're an umbrella as the development and alumni engagement department. We're the Office of Development and Alumni Engagement. And within that, we operate two 501c3 organizations. One is the foundation, the other is the Alumni Association. It sounds like semantics, and it is, but there was great confusion in understanding who's what. And so our team is the Development and Alumni Engagement team, operating with and on behalf of those two organizations. Something that'll be coming your way is the foundation's annual report. So I'm holding it up here. We will mail it to you, but it'll also be coming your way via email. I think you're really going to enjoy it, because one of my goals for the team was that we not distribute our audited financials as the report, but in fact, do we tell a story and the narrative about what your philanthropy helped us accomplish at Farmingdale, so that you can see the impact, so that you can see the return on your investment to Farmingdale, and hopefully inspiring you to do it again. And so I do want to thank everyone who participates in our fundraising efforts. And for those who haven't yet, June 30th is the end of our fiscal year, so you have time. And I appreciate everyone's participation. The gala, I can't remember if we recapped on that, but in short, it was a success. We netted about 100,000 when we normally net about 150. And considering it was a shotgun creative effort in response to we could raise nothing or something, we're all quite pleased that we raised $100,000, which is helping us close my segue to the annual fund and our unrestricted fundraising efforts. Unrestricted dollars are the most critical dollars we need. It allows us to triage and problem solve and troubleshoot for the college when there's needs to be met that are not otherwise available in the coffers of Vice President O'Connor. So while we're very focused on scholarship, we also are trying to grow those coffers. The annual fund, which is our unrestricted fundraising appeal for the Farmingdale Fund, has raised about $30,000 to date. It's a little bit behind where I would like it to be. But again, as you know, this was a re-engineered, reorganized effort that needs some continuity behind it for it to truly reap the rewards of the investment. That said, we spent a fraction of what we had in the past to raise $30,000. To put that into perspective, in the past, we have spent $30,000 on the annual fund. This year, we spent about $7,500 so far. We will spend that again one more time as we go into the spring appeal that you'll see the letter flow coming out in March. So there'll be another direct mailing campaign where I hope to double down on that figure. So that's the annual fund. It is crucial. It's imperative. And every gift counts and matters, whether it's $20 or $1,000. We have thousands of donors who have given to Farmingdale in the past who are multiple years lapsed. And so that's a focus of this year's annual fund, is to reactivate past donors, because acquisition for new business, as you all know, for those who run businesses, is very expensive. But we have so many people who have shared and voted for us in the past. They just haven't done so lately. And so we're focused on re-inspiring them to get on board. Major gifts is the second prong of our fundraising efforts. And yes, we had a relationship that started soon as I arrived by way of Dr. Nader's engaging with a donor who responded in a very generous way during our COVID outreach. And that's Murray Pasternak. You'll see an announcement next week that we were able to close a $500,000 gift for scholarship in engineering. It's the second largest major gift received by Farmingdale, second to Teresa Santman, who you all know and adore. The third piece to our fundraising efforts is the piece that still needs to be built. The major gift work is being done. There's a lot to be done. There's more people like Murray out there, and I'm really excited to get to know them. He came forward rather easily, and I had to let the president know to manage expectations. It's not always in 7 months that we can close a $500,000. But he did prime the pump well for me, so I'm grateful that it was an easier one to close. Planned giving is absent at Farmingdale, and we're a school that's 100 years old. We've got great alumni who are ripened for a planned gift in leaving us in their estate, in their will, leaving us to inherit their second property or to share securities, stocks, retirements, what have you. And so I'll be working on first securing some of the resources so that we can roll out a comprehensive planned giving program and solicitation effort for those who are in a position to consider leaving their legacy at Farmingdale.
Thank you.
The last piece of the puzzle, Patricia, and then I'm done, is we've been revving up the alumni engine. The groundswell of alumni activity has been very comforting, and we knew that they were there. We just hadn't been poking and prodding them enough. And so, James Durant, you've been a part of that effort with the alumni board as well, and you've seen, I hope you've noticed, that the communications going out to the alumni has increased significantly. Our Facebook page is on fire, and that's a good thing. And we're seeing many more alumni who we've never met before come forward. We're also integrating our academic units, working with the provost and the deans, so that we weave alumni into the fabric of the college, but also weave the college into the fabric of our alum everyday life. So we've been featuring faculty and alumni subject matter experts on panel discussions, and we'll be rotating through each school so that we're also promoting and raising brand awareness to our alums of those different schools and shining them in a bright light so they can champion the cause in our marketing and recruitment efforts, because we give them water cooler talk. And I don't think we're meeting at the water cooler right now, but that's the goal, is that when people are chatting and they ask what you did last night, you talk about Farmingdale. So you'll see we have a donor appreciation event coming up on March 4th, a virtual event with a guest speaker. We are also engaging our students, and Natalie, I think you'll appreciate hearing this, is also our effort to try to engage students and keep them connected. Our portfolio is the scholarship recipients, right? Those are the students we get to know best. And so we'll be doing a specific scholars workshop for career readiness and planning, featuring three of our major gift donors. So we get to engage our donors in an other way other than solicitation, for them to share their career path, how they found their success, and why giving to Farmingdale is so important to them, but also giving access to our students to top level professionals to learn about their career, begin building their professional network. And we would encourage that they start to engage and connect after this event so that they can start to put together their resources as they graduate and enter the workforce. That's what I got.
Thank you. Thank you. Excellent.
Patricia, I wanted to have Pat and Greg talk about enrollment, but if it's okay with you and council members, if Dave Curry is still on, I at least want to summarize what we've been conversing, that's the executive session topic, and then when we come back into session afterwards, we can get back to those two topics, time permitting, along those lines. Is that okay? Dave had indicated.
That will be fine with me, because I think we want to keep them a quorum for the executive session. Yeah, that would be fine.
Okay. I think we need to ask for a motion for that session, and then those not voting college council members or cabinet members, if you would just get off, and I think we'll try to communicate with you when we return.
Yes. Well, I'll entertain a motion to go into executive session from the council members.
Motion.
So moved.
I'm going to have a second.
Second.
Okay. All right. Motion has been made to go into executive session and approved. So we will move forward and return. So I'm going to recess the meeting and we'll reconvene. And how long do you think that will take, Dr. Nader? About 15 minutes or so?
Great guess. That's what I was going to say.
Okay, 15. We'll reconvene in about 15 minutes. Thank you very much. We're now back in general session. And what we'd like to do at this point is have a very brief presentation of a motion to be made before it's made. Would someone like to do that? And first, I'd like to ask Dr. Nader to do the brief summary, and then we'll have a motion by a council member.
For those who are part of the conversation, we're requesting that the College Council move to consider renaming Conklin Hall at Farmingdale State College in honor of a Long Island regional civil rights leader.
That is the basis of the motion. I'll entertain a motion to that effect from anyone on the College Council.
So moved.
But I have a second to that motion.
Second.
Second.
Very good. Motion has been made and approved and seconded and approved. And we will move forward with that. So with that, covering a very important part of the executive session portion of the session that we recess to, we'll move now to the next item on our agenda in the regular meeting. And that would be up to you, Dr. Nader, related to either the budget or enrollment or whatever on the agenda.
Pat, because you had some interruptions, maybe we should start with you to give a very brief summary of enrollment trends and go to Greg in case you
That's
have to.
That's fine, wherever you'd like.
Apologies, everyone, but I had a water main break and I had some damage in the house. So that's what I was trying to address while I was juggling the bowling pins. But I will be very brief. Our spring enrollment, really we're quite pleased with. We reached 98% of our, 99.7% of our target. That represents 9,063 students. We were particularly pleased with our transfer numbers, and we all know that's been a challenge. We've talked about that before. Our transfer numbers, we reached 102% of our target. So we're very pleased about that. Looking forward, it's still early, but we are 91% year to date in our applications compared to last year. So we're very much in the ballpark. We compare very favorably to applications with other SUNY colleges. For instance, in the tech sector, we have colleges that are down minus 31% in applications, minus 30%, minus 30%, minus 35%, minus 25%. We're down in applications 8.7%. That is one of the, while it's a decrease, it's one of the smallest decreases in all of SUNY. So we are certainly holding our own. I'm happy to answer any questions. And just let me say, I think you all know that I'm retiring within a few weeks. I'm really pleased where the enrollment is, that it's in good shape, and with the team that's in place in admissions, marketing, and the academic enterprise, I feel really good about where enrollment's going to be in the future as well.
Can't leave that, Pat.
Patrick, are you saying this is your last meeting with the College Council?
Yes, because you won't be meeting again till April.
Oh, we didn't know
that.
Oh, wow. Open to the public. You're welcome to join us at the April meeting. Yeah. We'll be sure you get an announcement on it.
You know what? I appreciate that, because what I really want to do in my retirement is attend the council meetings and give you my opinion all over.
Well, I want to thank everybody
for their support, not only of me, but of the college. I know how much the president appreciates it. I know how much the cabinet appreciates it. And I know that we feel, the cabinet feels very fortunate to have such a great and supportive council.
Well, Pat, we definitely, We're definitely going to miss you.
We're going to miss you, Pat.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Pat.
You're like a milestone in our.
Jim, I'm not dead.
That's people retire, but they never really go away, Pat.
You noticed that, right? You noticed that.
We'll have your expertise back on a volunteer assistant. We'll give you a stipend at the end, you know.
So,
penny.
Yeah, how many days?
Are you counting down, Pat? You're on mute.
Oh, no, I am enjoying every second of my transition.
Thank you, and thank you for everything. And Greg, on the financial piece, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be surprised by this, but I'll let Greg just run with it for a couple of minutes here.
All right. Thanks. I'll try to be brief. The last few times we've spoken, I've characterized things as kind of challenges and opportunities. So I'm going to keep with that same framework and just run through a couple of items. Overall, in our response to COVID, whether that was PPE, technology investment, refunds to students, and some additional testing expenses and things, we're all in on our recovery or response effort, about $5.2 million. So this has not been an inexpensive crisis to respond to. As we've looked at the state budget, you may recall from previous presentations, we receive $12.6 million every year from the state of New York and state tax, and that does not change. However, last year, 19-20, they only provided 80% of that amount. So that was a reduction of about $2.5 million right off the top. Couple that with our expense to respond, couple that with the university-wide programs, EOP, EOC, other diversity programs. They were only funded at 25%. The remaining 75% of that was put on the back of the campus. We've had an increase in our accounts receivable across the board. We're about 26% in terms of cash receipts is where we were compared to last year. This is just a function of people not having the wherewithal to pay their bills. They're waiting, they're hanging on to cash.
Joanne? Sorry.
That's all right. And we've also been anticipating a 20% cut consistent with last year for this year's budget. So the state has asked us to hold our employment numbers consistent with where we were April 1st in both in terms of headcount, FTE, as well as the salary expense. So a lot of challenges. We've seen some relief thus far in that we received about $6.2 million in the CARES Act fund, 3.1 of which was directed to students, students of high need. These were Pell eligible and other Title IV eligible students. So that was 3.1 million that we spread across that population of students based on estimated family contribution. And then 3.1 million went to the institution. And that fits squarely into the amount of refunds that we provided back in spring. So that plugged that hole pretty nicely for us. In December 20, we also saw the COVID Relief Act passed in Washington. This was the first round of funding. We don't have these funds yet, but we're anticipating that Farmingdale, both the students and the institution, will benefit from around $12 million of that initial relief package. About a little more than three, will go to students, consistent with the CARES Act, and just over $9 million will be directed to the institution to help us respond to the crisis. So you remember that 5.2, nine's bigger than five, so we make out on that pretty nicely. We're also looking at the state budget environment. And this is fairly promising and somewhat of a surprise when we saw Governor Cuomo's executive budget released several weeks ago. All of this is contingent on an additional federal relief package. The state requested $15 billion. It looks like the state may benefit from $6 billion. If we do get that $6 billion, last year's 20% cut will be fully restored. This year's anticipated 20% cut will be reduced to 5%. And the university-wide programs, which total about $6 million, which we've been floating, will be fully restored at 100%. So where we thought we would need to absorb $2.5 million in cut last year, $2.5 million in cut this year, we're really just looking at a total cut of about 600,000. With the savings that we've experienced because of the reduced or held flat headcount back in April, that's about $3 million. With the COVID relief funding, looking at an additional $9 million. All of these things are looking more and more positive. So where we were several months ago, it was one challenge after another. We started to see some improved environment, some improved opportunity. Thankfully, as you just heard from Vice President Calabria, our enrollment has remained stable. We are hitting our targets. Altogether, we are in a very healthy financial position. With all of these cuts, with all of these challenges, with all of these increased expenditures on COVID response, our cash reserves have actually gone up. We're anticipating, as these cuts in the state of New York are restored, as additional COVID relief funding is received, that cash reserve will go up even more. That is unique in the system. As you heard Pat describe the enrollment environment in terms of applications, in terms of total enrollment, we're seeing decreases across the state. We all have also seen decreases in cash reserves across the system. We are one institution that has actually seen an appreciation in that cash balance. So overall, revenue, cash, expense has been contained very effectively. We've done a good job in the last year, and I'm very pleased to report those numbers to you today.
Thank you, Greg. I have a question related to the announcement of maybe early retirement. Could you give us a few little bits of tidbits on that announcement?
Sure. So,
and how it impacts Farmingdale?
Right. It's as much of an incentive as we could really cobble together locally on the campus. And this is a local program. It's not a system-wide program. And it is a phased retirement. So someone who decides that they would like to retire effective fall could come to us now and say they would like to phase to retirement. So they could work a 50% load. They could work half time if they're a professional. We would pay them half their salary, but that would reduce their commitment, their time commitment to the institution by a commensurate amount for a predetermined amount of time, say 6 months. So half a year, you'd work half time. And then at the end of those 6 months, you would effectively retire. So the idea is it gives somebody a phase to retirement. It helps them make that transition. As Pat was describing, he's enjoyed his transition. This would allow someone to enjoy, it would give them half their time back. It would not affect their benefits. It would not affect their retirement. But it would allow somebody to make that transition in a little bit of a less abrupt way.
So this is just decided upon by campus. It's not a statewide SUNY package.
No,
it's not.
I would just like to, for the council, underscore or build on one thing that Greg touched on. We are in very good shape. We do not have the latitude to use the vast majority of the reserves and cash that we have generated. We seem in a very anomalous situation. Laura and Greg and I met last week to decide on backfilling positions that already exist, but we have done very little, not nothing, but very little by way of new staffing, even though we can identify needs in particular areas. And that's not a byproduct of the campus's situation. It's a byproduct of COVID and the state and the university situation. So we're hoping, and we're, I think, optimistic, as Greg said, that will get to the point where that's somewhat relaxed. The other thing I would point out, and some of you may know this, is we are truly an outlier, okay? Matt Coulson and I were texting last night about the University of Kansas, which is eliminating its humanities program. Okay, it's eliminating their version of a visual communications program as well. They have other programs that they're looking very closely at. There are colleges in the state of New York, including my undergraduate alma mater, that are laying faculty off. There are campuses that are really struggling in this environment nationally. The SUNY system, though we have some campuses that are really facing some challenges, SUNY system comparatively is in relatively good shape. And we particularly, along with a few other campuses, are at the high end of that at this point. But I want people to understand that there's a tipping point between an institution that's really struggling and one that thinks that it's doing well. I mean, literally last night at 8 o'clock, Matt, we're texting back and forth, they're eliminating humanities, things of that sort. So there are both publics and privates that are laying people off at this point and facing significant enrollment declines.
Are there any other questions for Greg? No? Dr. Nader, would you like to add anything else to the agenda under your...
No, I thank everybody for their time on this. Just a reminder that Patricia's on tomorrow at 5, live at 5 on Facebook, and thank you for doing that. We'll be back to you about the motion with greater details, and we'll reach out on that. Okay. I think that's what I have, unless council members have something that we should be in conversation about or a question.
Are there any other comments you'd like to make? I do want to say that when I finish writing that presentation for tomorrow, I do plan to include in my presentation a bit about the SUNY, the Chancellor's new initiative for SUNY, you know. So, just briefly, as that will be there for SUNY. I feel I have to do that as the ACT rep. What is it, SUNY for everybody? Is that how it's called? And explain it a little bit. I was asked to do that too. Any other comments?
Dr. Nader?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just curious, probably a very simple answer. How much of your staff has physically return to campus, and how many are still working remotely?
That's actually a very good question, Kathleen. Only a few hundred faculty and staff, and we have 1,600 employees, have a what we call a regular on-campus presence. And on any given day, because people have different schedules, that number is actually much lower than those who are approved to be here in a particular time. So if you look around at today's call, Laura and Matt and I are here, but other people, and Dr. Jordan, other people are not. The majority of our sections, vast majority, as the provost pointed out, are being delivered remotely. Pete, you see on a daily basis who fills out the screening form and the number of devices on campus. Maybe you have a more specific number for Kathleen.
Normally I have that up on my screen here, but I'll have to circle back with you.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you planning a phase back approach with your staff? Are you looking to get the 85% like students back on campus in the fall?
I actually, I don't have a target in mind, and I don't think cabinet's really discussed it in that way. I have asked Mary Beth in Candela to look at, even as we return to campus in larger numbers, how many people could continue to work remotely and do so effectively so that we have greater distancing and spacing within the offices. We have kind of a tiered approach to this. Greg, anything you'd want to add to that?
Yeah, the only thing I would say, and similar to the academic piece where there is kind of a statutory regulatory component to it that authorizes us to deliver remote instruction, the same is true with working remotely. The Governor's Office of Employee Relations has extended our ability for remote work through the spring. So we're in a position now until May to work in this model. Doing anything in the fall would be predicated on further extension of that, guidance from the governor's office, guidance from system. Right now, we've tiered our employees into 7 groups, and the essential personnel and tier one are the only people who are authorized to be on campus. It's a very, very small number. And we intend to keep it that way for as long as we're authorized to do so, because right now it's just not prudent. If people are able to do their work at home, we are encouraging them to do so. We want to protect them.
Are our staff, faculty, et cetera, being encouraged to get the COVID shot on their own wherever, but is there any encouragement in that being a part of return?
There's no SUNY or institutional encouragement to do so because the vaccine itself remains in such limited supply. I think as more are rolled out, I expect we will hear from the university about what kind of encouragement might be offered along those lines. To give you a specific feel, by the way, going back to Kathleen's question, so the reason I got up is to look into these very large parking lots in front of Horton. There are approximately a dozen vehicles there. Mm. And you know what it would have been like a year ago to this day to find a parking spot out there in the morning.
Go ahead, Greg. That question about vaccinations, interesting. In the governor's reauthorization of his executive order, he also included in their requirement for K-12 systems or school districts to collect data about teachers who have been vaccinated. Huh. In addition to that, and we're required as of today to report to the governor's office or the Department of Health the total number of teachers who have been vaccinated. We had to send out a Google survey form this morning to collect that information. Also, there was a restriction on teachers being vaccinated at hospitals that has been lifted. As a result, the Nassau University Medical Center is providing us with about 500 vaccines. So I think now there's going to be a movement for us to really require people to get vaccinated in the K-12 system.
I would hope so. We have no such guidance here at this point. I would love to see that, Ken.
Yeah.
I have my shot. I got my shot.
I looked at the dashboard.
Yeah, one question.
I looked at the COVID dashboard. You're right. It's about 200 employees a day who are coming to campus and filling out the dashboard, and in the neighborhood of 600 students.
The other question, I got two questions.
Yes,
one's to Greg. All federal stimulus money actually would go to Albany first. Then it's going to be redistributed out to the colleges and universities.
I think that depends. In the case of the CARES funding, it came directly here from U.S. Department of Education. Wow. And we were reporting directly to them in terms of the usage and compliance. The system and the controller's office are auditing those expenditures. And we've yet to see guidance in terms of the COVID Relief Act from December, exactly how those dollars will flow. But, you know, for us, it's somewhat transparent. The system accounts are integrated with our local accounts, and it's a fairly easy transaction to move things back and forth. We do it all the time. So if it does have to make a pit stop, as long as we get what's coming to us, I'm kind of agnostic in terms of if it has to go to the system first.
Okay. My other question, Dr. Nader, it's under my understanding that we are in a freeze right now for the hiring of staff and faculty.
It's not exactly a freeze, Jim. We are required to hold headcount, full-time equivalent employee, and salary expense as of the April 1st numbers. So that was the beginning of the state fiscal year. To this point, we are actually down close to 200 on absolute headcount, and we are down close to $3 million on salary expense annualized. So we are well below where we need to be. So we can backfill, and we've been doing that. As Dr. Nader mentioned, we met with the provost last week and talked about some key programs. If we don't have staff in those programs, in particular the new ones, or high demand programs, we can't teach. Therefore, we can't do our work. So it is not an absolute freeze. It's a cap, and we're well below that cap.
Pat's not there. I got a question for Pat.
I'm here.
No.
Oh, the other Pat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he just stepped. Here he comes.
That's okay.
He's coming back. Patrick, Jim has a question for you.
Hey, Pat, I was really curious about the numbers of enrollment. What area of the schools are we low based on the applications, you know, the number of applications going to particular schools?
What other schools are low?
Yeah.
Pretty much everybody.
Are we good in the technology school, the engineering technology, or the school?
By school.
Right. By school.
I can circle back to you that on that, Jim.
Okay.
You know, we're not seeing a depreciable difference in the one area. So, you know, business remains strong. Energy technology remains strong. The new programs that we've launched over the last 3 years, they're all doing well. I don't think there's a one particular area that is of concern. There may be an area that is more dramatic than others, but I don't think there's anything that is very troublesome at this point.
Jim, the real
how about postgrad?
Okay, sorry.
Postgrad, the master program.
The master program is strong. We're doing well. We've met our target there.
Yeah. The real challenge, Jim, is the precipitous decline in the number of transfer applications because of the enrollment declines that are being experienced at both Nassau and Suffolk, where enrollment is off pretty dramatically. Compared to even a few years ago. So we're down far less than almost every other institution. As Kathleen probably knows, the university centers seem to be holding up well. But we are losing like a few hundred transfer applications at this point. So.
Well, are there any other comments? If not, is there any other business to be placed on the table? If not, I want to thank everyone for this particular meeting. We've had a lot of information shared with us. And Carolyn, our next meeting is scheduled for when?
April 7th, right. 10 a.m. April 7th.
Okay. That's a Wednesday. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I'll have a motion to adjourn.
No move.
It's second. Thank you all for being here and have a nice, have a safe time.
Thank you.
See you soon. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, everyone.